impacted. One of the opioid use mosquitoes at our facility, so look forward to the report, and the education is being rolled out.
Al, one question. In other cities, is there any history around this type of program and the impact that it's had?
It is still looking pretty new, and there's some hesitancy among some law enforcement entities to provide the training and the equipment to their officers and others in other cities. Being a heavily urbanized area, I expected more of the outliers to be interested as well, which proved out, you know. Some of the larger departments would like it for their own individuals, their drug interdiction teams, their multi-agency interdiction teams. But as of now, I haven't had any hard data from other departments.
You asked exactly the question I was going to ask. If there was precedent in any other state or city services that have done this before, whether there was any potential hangups associated with non-EMS, not essentially administering medication?
Not here. The latest legislative session created an environment where laypersons can administer Narcan. They can go to a pharmacist and say, I need some Narcan, and they'll then get it either through their insurance or pay a full price for it. And they can administer it as a good Samaritan. So those unlicensed individuals do have protection here.
Mr. Chairman, is the grant associated for education or actually the purchasing of the pharmaceuticals? So, and then who do you determine that, who that gets deployed to and what locations?
We've reached out to the law enforcement entities within Clark County. So we're going to reach out to them first with training. First, well, initially we're going to do face-to-face training, and we want to move it onto an online format as well, just to get them a little more flexibility. Metro can't call in 3,000 officers and have them all trained. That would take a long time to get those officers trained. We'll hand it out as far as it can go. We will not withhold training for pretty much anybody who wants to receive it. And as long as we have the medication to distribute, we will. Throughout the county and then hopefully up through some of the northern counties.
And we plan to implement this through our own pharmacy here. Sure. We'll be helping with the deployment of it. I don't think it's a replacement for hospitals, but or for EMS, because it's that's a reimbursable kind of a thing with insurance. But it would be for kind of non-standard providers, as I recall.
Yes.
Would that be hotel security or
police officers, hotel security? Members of the community have a relative with opioid use issues.
So is this
a
lifestyle issue or is this lifestyle versus any of the money spent towards actual detox treatment?
No, it goes to tracking, referral, and research. So there'll be some money for epidemiological studies to determine if what we're doing is effective. There's other programs we're going to dovetail into, and not allowed to replicate those programs. We're going to dovetail into the treatment and rehab side of it, so we can meet the needs of the individual. Marla has an idea about
peer
navigators and individuals as
well.
Because
we do
have
five positions, there's Suboxone
Certified and one of
Vista.
Kevin,
Leonard
from Spring Valley, Illinois. Are those nurses?
Suboxone
Certified, are they nurses?
Yeah, right, are those nurses?
One more question regarding the condition. Once we train, is there some sort of a certification or a card that they carry? Is it to identify that they are able to appropriately administer the Narcan?
We will give them a certificate, and online training as well will be able to print a certificate. It's not something they'll have to evidence, to get it. The one thing that's going to be probably the most problematic is to get data back from the individuals who administer the Narcan. So we have to get data back from them to say, you gave it, did it work, who did you kind of give it to? That stuff I think is going to be some of the sticking points. Everybody loves more paperwork, especially police officers.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hammond. And now that we've got the phone lines working, I know many of you are on the phone and we're listening to some hold music, so we apologize. So I'm going to go back to the item number three, is the adoption of the November 13th agenda. That's, we have an official quorum, but I would like to take a quick roll call so we can ensure for the public record that we've got everyone in attendance that's on the phone.
Thank you. Do we have Boulder City Hospital?
Yes, I'm there.
Thank you. Do we have anyone from Dignity Health? Do we have anyone from HCA?
Just.
Other than Todd. Do we have Mesa View Hospital? Do we have anyone from North Vista Hospital? Thank you. Do we have anyone from UHS Valley Health Systems? I heard Leonard Freehouse and Alan Eakes. Is that correct? And Rob from Summerlin. Thank you. And do we have the VA or West Care? Robert? Vickery? Okay, thank you. We have quorum.
Great. Thank you, Katie. That will take us to adoption of the agenda. Do I have a motion to approve today's agenda? Motion.
Second, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We all in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes. We also, on item number four, is the consent agenda, approval of the minutes from the prior meeting, which is on consent. I don't think I need a vote on that through the consent agenda. Do I?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So moved.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, now back to item five. Issue number one is the proposed 2018 Facility Advisory Board meeting schedule. In front of you or in your packets was the meetings for 2018. We've got four meetings. It looks like that's the fourth Tuesday of the month.
Yes, it is.
So hopefully those dates work with everyone on the committee, but I'd like to get a motion to approve these dates for next year.
We need to change the time. We're historically at 2 o'clock, but there was a request to either move it to 2:30 or 3 due to a standing meeting minute that you have.
Oh, okay. Great. Any issues, any suggestions on the time, 3 or?
2:30 or 3.
2:30 or 3, does that work with everyone else? For now, any issues, maybe shoot me an email back later on and we can look at that time, but if we could move that to 2:30.
2:30 is the confirmed.
We're at 3 o'clock. Anybody on the phone opposed 3 o'clock? Okay, that's so just 3.
3. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
We need to vote.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Can I get a motion to approve the 2018 dates for the Facility Advisory Board?
So moved.
Second.
All right. All in favor? Thank you, everyone. Motion passes. Now back to item five. We received a report from Mr. Hammond related to the first responder Narcan. Now we're going to receive a report related to the emergency department closure policies. And we appreciate this reminder. I know flu season has already begun. There's been cases reported to the Southern Nevada Health District. So, and a death. Okay, I'm sorry. And a death, unfortunately, related to the flu.
Right.
So, Mr. Hammond, please take it away related to the reminder of the policies related to emergency departments closures.
Right. For those of you who don't have the, or not present in the meeting here, we do have the procedures online on the EMS website at the Southern Nevada Health District. Several years ago, all the CEOs of health districts got together to discuss what was historically a problem around this time of year with the seasonal closures of hospitals and everybody going on internal disaster at the same time, leaving most EMS providers no place to go, no home to go home. So we developed this process where we regionalized the valley into northwest, southwest, central, and south areas. We placed hospitals in those districts, and we came up with a procedure to provide one hospital is on internal disaster in a particular area, that if another one would go on internal disaster, then they both would be taken off because there's just no other place for them to transport patients. It helps quite a bit if the hospitals are in communication with each other in their region and understand that if one would go on to an internal disaster and another one did, that the understanding is that both would be rebuilt and would be ignored. While it's not entirely painless, it has worked well in the past, and moving forward, we continue this process so we can get the patients to the right place at the right time with the minimum of issue. What is really important, though, and something I have to reiterate quite a bit, is the reason that the hospital goes on internal disaster should be documented in the EM system so that if the internal disaster is based on something that totally precludes anyone from going to a hospital, fire, famine, flood, shooter, anything like that, that the crews would then understand that. But if it's not based in the comments section, then they don't know. It's just blank. That seems to be the biggest reason given is no reason given. So. Because staffing puts staffing, the drop-down menu is pretty self-explanatory, so I just implore everyone to use to give the reason should it be something other than just a staffing issue.
Mr. Hammond, thank you for that reminder and update. Are all hospitals on an EM system that we actually know?
Yes. The only ones that are not, this policy does not apply to are the four micro hospitals from Dignity and the HCA. Off-site campus. They receive a small cohort of patients that are not generally affected by this, so they're not actually in this policy.
I guess that begs the question, should they? Obviously, they advertise as an emergency department. Just raising the question related to, should they be included, excluded, and for what reason?
It's understandable. They are on the EM system. But they're not in this particular policy because the cohort of patients they receive from EMS is very limited. It's a very conservative protocol for them, and those types of patients are minimal acuity anyway. So we just kept it to the larger acute care facilities rather than the off-site ones.
I believe yours is at the Lakes.
Right, and it is, I get technically the department of the hospital, so I would make the assumption, don't want to speak on behalf of Southern Hills, but whatever the decision is with Southern Hills' emergency room would also pertain since it is a department.
Yeah, and if they go on internal disaster at the ER Lakes, it's not going to affect the procedures of the policy itself.
And Mr. Chair, I have
a question. Yes, please.
Last year, at least, through this calendar year, have we had issues community-wide with multiple hospitals within the zones going on diversion?
Not generally, no. The internal disaster numbers have been decreasing slightly over the last year. They're almost in total.
Good.
I mean, well, this is just there. They are manageable. It's much better than it has been in the past. But I suppose that all depends on how this new season is going to shake out. So I don't know what the Crystal Balls are saying in this regard, but
I think it's going to be somewhat of an average season from what I hear, but you never know. Yeah. I don't think Washoe County, you know, they're usually ahead of us time-wise, and they're not doing too badly, but they have had some issues up there. And you'll have to remind me, because I lose track of the years now that I've been here several, but I don't think we had significant closures last year at all. I think it was the year before or the year before that.
Yes.
I think it was the year before that one where we did have, because I remember, you remember, we had two conference calls, I think, that same year because of this issue and my begging you to remain open because otherwise we couldn't handle the volume.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's important to document the reasons so we can track the particular issues. But again, I know we all try to avoid being on closure or longer offload time. So again, very important to document. So thank you for that reminder. Okay, moving on to item number four, receive a report from Dr. Michael Johnson addressing the physician shortage in Nevada. So looking forward to that and hopefully we're making progress.
Well, we'll paint the picture here.
Okay.
Let me just get this pulled up.
Has anyone else come on the line since we've done a roll call?
Yeah, Teresa Conley is here from Saint Rose.
Thank you.
This is Bill Washington, the Ohio Hospital Association as well.
Thank you. What was the last?
Alan Heeks with Spring Mountain.
Thank you. Okay, Dr. Johnson, please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Wanted to take a few moments just to provide you with a report on the rising demand for more residents and training programs here in Nevada. This research project really was conducted by one of our medical residents, Chow Pham, who a lot of our medical residents will come in and do a stint here and oftentimes work on research projects, so she's a good example of that. And I wanted to share with you some of the key takeaways from this issue on the provider shortage. First of all, if you look at where all the providers have gone and the ratio of primary care physicians and dentists here in Nevada relative to some of the closer states in New Mexico, we could see that provider access is very poor in Clark County, particularly as you might compare it to New Mexico. And as you know, Clark County is one of the largest growing counties in the country. Had the 10th highest growing rate of nearly 6% from 2010 to 2014. And of course, aging population growth and the influx of patients under ACA can also affect provider access. But the takeaway from this slide really is just the big ratio of primary care providers and dentists to patients. A few more sober figures. The physician workforce here in Nevada would need to double, or in Southern Nevada, to meet the demands of the populations within health professional shortage areas. And we need over 1,100 primary care physicians in the state in order to meet the needs of the in demand by 2030 to maintain our current primary care utilization rates. And there's persistent specialty shortages, which I'll illustrate in just a moment. So the purpose of the study really was to look at the physician workforce supply in Nevada in the context of residency programs, and then to help enhance awareness and support for policy solutions. The data and methods that were used was we obtained matriculate data from all local medical schools, including UNR, UNLV, Toro, and Roseman, and we extrapolated resident specialty preferences based on the national data broken down for specialty choices from the National Resident Matching Program, and then derived the number of graduates who have to go out of state for residency training by subtracting the postgraduate year one positions from matriculants. What Table 1 illustrates is the matriculation data from each medical school and the estimated numbers of medical school graduates from 2016 to 2022. For many years, UNR, as you're probably aware, has been sending medical students for clinical clerkships to Southern Nevada. However, starting in the fall, UNLV starts first class and take over clinical rotation sites. It's projected to produce its first graduating class of 60 students, as you can see, in 2021, and an estimated 120 students each year in subsequent years, which will bring our total estimated graduates to 265 in 2021 and 385 in 2022. Table 2 illustrates the current specialties and their postgraduate year one positions of 2017 offered by UNR, UNLV Valley, and Mountain View. Mountain View Hospital opened their first residency program in 2016, and in July with the new medical school at UNLV, they will run 10 residency programs in Las Vegas. UNR continue to manage their programs in Reno. So taken together, the total number of postgraduate year one positions for all available specialties in the state was 159 in 2017. Table 3 summarizes the specialty breakdown from the national NRMP data, and gives the estimated numbers of in-state medical graduates by specialty, extrapolated from the national makeup. We then derive the number of those needed to seek out-of-state residency training in year 2022, based on that 2022 projection of matriculates. So what does this all mean? By the numbers, really, there will be a total projected 385 medical student graduates being produced each year starting in 2022. And each medical graduate with an MD or DO will then need to finish a minimum three-year training before fully licensed. And without enough residency slots to accommodate for new graduates, Nevada physician shortages won't be resolved. In fact, will get worse. In Southern Nevada, we currently have 15 residency training programs with 110 postgraduate year one positions. And in Northern Nevada, there are only three programs. So the crisis really gets bigger. By 2022, the increases of in-state medical graduates and the limited residency programs and slots are going to force many medical graduates to seek out-of-state training positions. This will cause more physicians to relocate in other states, further worsening the insufficient supply here. Family medicine, internal medicine, and pediatrics are among the top specialties that will require more medical graduates, sending more medical graduates out of state. And with the growing and aging population and an increased number of patients due to more access to health insurance, health physician shortages are expected to be worsening without immediate intervention. So these data argue for a strong need to expand graduate medical education residency programs. We feel state funding should be provided to expand residency positions in high-need specialties, such as family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, general surgery, and psychiatry. Another solution would be to encourage current residency programs to give priority to local medical graduates, as it's historically shown that physicians are more likely to practice medicine nearby their residency programs, which of course is another concern we have with folks going out of state, that they, for that very reason, they won't come back. We did some projections assuming a 30% increase in residency programs for five-year increments from 2017 onward to help motivate actions on this crisis. So if we assume a pace of residency expansion at 30% in five-year increments, as you can see on the blue trend line on the left-hand chart, it amounts to about 206 slots by 2022, 254 slots in 2027, and 302 slots in 2032, and so forth. We expect to see about one-third of the graduates going for out-of-state residency training in 2027, as shown on the right-hand chart. The percentage will decrease to just over one-fifth by 2032 if the pace of expansion continues in this linear fashion. On the other hand, if the rate increases exponentially, that is proportional to the total slots available at the time point, we can see an accelerated decline in the percentage going out of state, as shown in the orange trend line. So by 2032, we'd have less than 10% going out of state for out-of-state residency programs. This is a way to sort of look at some possible scenarios of how this might be improved. So it is an uphill climb. Looking ahead, we need more residency expansion and collaboration options, and we need to act now in order to put a dent in the projected proportion of graduates going out of state. They illustrate the acute shortages Nevada faces in almost every medical specialty. So this compares U.S. physicians per 100,000 to Nevada, and you can see the shortage is higher in Nevada for all of these specialties. Certainly some more than others. So, any questions?
So from Eric's presentation, I've actually not seen it in that format before. I know many of the hospitals that here and on the phone doing their part, but obviously we're still falling short. Has this been shared with anyone else? I think the health board needs to see this, the health district board needs to see this presentation, so I would recommend that going up as a presentation, but...
You're the first group.
Okay, yeah, I think we need to share that with them.
Actually, my original goal was to share this with the legislature, because they're the ones who gave the governor a couple of years ago the additional funds to increase residencies. And if you look at the bottleneck, I mean, Turo has now been approved to, I think, increase its graduates by 50%. I think they go up to 180. That doesn't matter, because they'll have to go out of state. So the bottleneck is the number of graduates to the number of residencies to the need. And unless we can decrease that bottleneck, we will never, as Mike has pointed out, will never meet the need of our own state with all of these graduates coming through. So yes, we originally talked to Chow Fam about doing this so that we can present it to the state as a whole. And so my goal would be to send it to the legislative interim committee this coming year. They'll be starting to meet in January or February, because that's where the other bottleneck is the funding for these programs.
And I think your recommendation certainly should be heavily weighted related to giving priority to Nevada residents, Nevada medical students for the residency program, because the data does show medical school coupled with state residency goes up to well over 70% of them staying in the state post-study, so it's about 70.
Yeah, you know, I'm sort of the key points person when a lot of these, the unsigned residents have come and do the rotations. I see them at the end of the month, but even those folks, I ask them, you know, routinely, where are you thinking of going next? What are you planning on doing? And consistently, 100% of the time, they're heading out of state, either because there's not a specialty within state that fits their needs, or the specialty within state, the slots are full. So,
is there a way we can get a copy of that presentation? I know Air Force is looking, in general, actually, the whole Department of Defense is looking to improve our military civilian partnerships. I know for us, we're going to be standing up at the VGYN military-civilian ACGB residency program. We already have emergency medicine and general surgery, and we're looking at maybe possibly even doing a second family medicine residency. Again, they get with the civilian partnership where we take on civilian residents in addition to the military. So this would be useful information for me to bring up to the Air Force chain as we look to expand our footprint.
Yeah, absolutely. Edie, if you could.
They're going right now.
So you have them in your
box right now.
We do now. I mean, our emergency medical
side, she's sending them to you, and you may have it.
Oh, I may have it in my box.
Yeah, I did.
Of course, we speak to you, girl. Yes. Edie's pretty fast. We'll make sure.
Any other questions? And I think, you know, we've got Bill Welsh on the phone as well, who's keenly aware of the issues. So I would suggest if you need any help from this body or the association, we'd certainly be glad to get involved and speak or travel with you at Carson City as well.
Great, thank you.
Any questions?
Mason, this is Bill.
Yes, Bill, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Just a couple comments. The legislature did approve $10 million in 2015 to help expand residency training programs in the state of Nevada. Those monies were awarded over a two-year period of time, and based upon the applications that came through that committee, there was projected significant growth of the residency training programs in the state. And so, without having seen the slide presentation, I'm curious as to whether or not the slide presentation included the projected growth of the residency training programs. Most new developing residency training programs take 3 to 5 years to fully mature. So I know that there are several, in Southern Nevada particularly, that's where the most growth is going to be, was going to be ramping up through the year, I believe, 2022, to the point that the residency slots that we had here several years ago was approximately, and I don't have the exact numbers here in front of me right now, but I'd be happy to provide this data to the committee. But we were right around 400 plus, and by the year 2022, we were supposed to be cresting 2,000 residency slots in the state at that point. I do think there were some points made in that we are graduating far more medical students than we have residency slots, and that is truly a bottleneck problem. A significant portion of those, however, though, are even state because the specialty that they want to move into are not currently available in the state. So one of the areas that we might want to consider is how we expand the fellowship program so that some of these students would have an opportunity to train here in this state in those specialty areas, because as I'm sure the data shows, we are, for the most part, having a physician shortage in every category. With the 2015 money, those were focused specifically to primary care-related physician categories. The legislature approved another $10 million in 2017. The governor appointed his commission again, and I am serving on the new governor's task force on this issue, and we've started to meet, and there will be $10 million that will be awarded over the next 18 months at this point to help further expand residency training programs. So there is a lot going on, but I would agree with the presenter in that there's a lot more that could and should be done.
Great. Thank you, Bill, for that insight. And I agree that the fellowships are a key part of this as well. So we'll get that presentation to you to make sure it incorporates the growth that we've had. I know we've had psychiatry residencies grow, OB-GYN, internal medicine. So we'll get that to you to make sure the numbers correlate. Then coupled with this is the nursing shortage, too, that we cannot be mindful of, and I saw a stat this morning, I think well over 20% of the nurses in the nation are going to be retiring in the next year, so obviously a key issue for us as well in the state of Nevada, and something that we need to address as well. Okay, next we're going to receive a report on teen pregnancy prevention, and there's a grant associated with that. Dr. Chauncey, are you going to be giving that report?
Actually, Dr. Legan is.
Again?
Yeah.
Please
come up and look forward to your reporting. Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for being here, Director of Clinical Services at Orange Street. So we will be talking today about teen pregnancy prevention and the issues that we are dealing with right now. Just to introduce this issue is the teen pregnancy rates in Nevada. As you can see, Nevada ranks between 38 and 34 in different areas. Like, for example, teen pregnancy rate is 38 in the country. And the decline of that teen pregnancy rate, Nevada ranks in 24. This is the rate from the United States in 2016. In teen pregnancy, it was about 20 women per 1,000 women in 2016. When we look at Clark County and the state of Nevada, they both have a very similar rate. It's about 26, 27 per 1,000 women. So even so, there have been a decline on teen pregnancy rates in the state and the county in recent years, it hasn't matched the decline at the national level. Now, our main concern today regarding this program is that last June, so about 4 months ago, we received a notification from the federal government telling us that this grant will end next June 30, 2018. Actually, that would represent a cut of 2 years with of the 5 years grant. And this is a grant that have been present here in this community since 2010, actually, effective 2011. And there are a lot of activities being carried out now by this program here. This is a $750,000 a year grant. We have the grant is to have 5 employees, all they are health educators, really well-trained health educators with a lot of knowledge and experience in teen pregnancy. They have been all over the community. They are known by many youth organizations and groups and community partners who are also working with the youth population as well. This is a program that when it started in 2010, they have the main goal was to have a reduction in birth rate of about 15% by the year 2020. And also, most of the goals and objectives were about increasing education among the youth, education about not just only pregnancy, but also HIV/AIDS, sexually transmitted diseases, and other areas. This is a matter, just trying to show you what the target area in this community. Mostly that these are sausage goals in Las Vegas, and also in the city of Vegas, mostly the central area of the city of Las Vegas. These projects have been partnered with other groups, like for example, Children First, Southern Nevada, Planned Parenthood, the county, and other community groups. The main target for this grant has been the adolescents, actually 13 to 19 years old, who are either in detention, probation, or foster care, and also working with the parents of this group. In addition to that, even so, the grant is not actually involved in the school system because of limitations with getting agreement with the school. They have been working with the schools at different levels, providing sexual education and resources to a student from high school that have actually approached the program. The program has multiple activities in the community. I would say that perhaps the strongest communication they have is through social media with the youth. And you can see there are some of the activities they do with Instagram and also do a lot of Twitter and other online activities. But also they provide other, I would call, physical encounters, communication with the youth. Like, for example, they at some point they rent movie theaters in the community and they provide a health education to a lot of youth that go to those activities. They also have youth gatherings in different areas of the community where they also exchange the message of this program. Now, what are the implications from losing this grant? First, again, there is a lot of outreach work during the community. That's something that will be lost. This program today perhaps is the one with the largest access to youth in our community. That's something that will be lost. Also, community-based organizations and other groups that feed from the information and the knowledge from this grant, they will lose that resource. And another thing is, especially for the Title 10 participants or family planning participants, they have the request of incrementing the abstinence, sexual abstinence, This is a resource that they would lose because they would, they would not have this program available. This program, in average, provides every month about 600 educational items to individuals in the communities. And also, that is about 900 individuals every year that are targeted and receive education from this program, especially parents and adolescents from those high risk group. In terms of community mobilization, and this is more after we received this notification from the federal government that we will be losing this grant, there is a community advisory group that have been working with other community partners, and they can have different activities. Like, for example, there were a letter sent to a state legislators. Also, we have sent signed letters to different national representatives in Congress, and then we also have been doing a campaign. We have a community summit last June, where we have more than 60 participants from youth organizations, local elected officials from the school system, and community partners. All those activities have been actually geared towards increasing awareness about the use of this program and the multiple resources that could be lost with that. These are two reports here in the local newspapers. I just wanted to show you that because you read the headline of those articles. One is telling you about the highest rate of teen pregnancy in Nevada's or Las Vegas poor neighborhoods, and those are the neighborhoods that we show in our map, and it's a target area for this program. And then you have a more positive report talking about decreased rates of teen pregnancy in Nevada, just as far as the national trend. And depending how you want to look at this, I mean, most of them are true, but perhaps our biggest concern and the biggest truth today is the issue that we have a very high rates of teen pregnancy among the youth adults at risk, and especially in those poor neighborhoods and targeted areas that we mentioned before. And I believe this is our last.
Thank you, Doctor. Fortunate outcome, and I know that you're doing a lot of good work out in the community related to teen pregnancy. So is there any questions for the doctor related to the grant? It sounds like you're trying to find some alternatives and community support.
If you keep the issue going, we can find additional funding. We've presented this to the advisory board and to the regular board of health and asked them to help find us funding because we don't have enough general fund property tax funds to replace this program. We just don't. No matter how good it does, we don't have that. Now, the board may tell us that we need to, but then they have to tell us where we have to cut someplace else in order to do that because we just don't have the funds. And we are part of it's now 30 cities, Big Cities Health Coalition, and as a group, we have written to Congress as well. We're a signatory on that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you again, Doctor.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to item 6, receive a report from the Chief Health Officer, Dr. Heiser.
Thanks. Just a brief parvovirus update, and ED has reminded us that there's another meeting coming at 2. So I've asked Laura, you sitting to your 2:15, did you say? So it depends on how late you all want to stay. Laura is here, can do her presentation. If you would like. So my arbovirus report, which is not the only thing I really want to tell you about, is that we've had a very mild season. We've had 3 West Nile virus cases. which is fewer than what I think we've seen in the past, although two of those died. I don't think we've had any Western equine encephalitis cases, and very few Zika that have been imported. Compared to northern Nevada, where they've had the flooding and lots of hordes of mosquitoes, they've had lots of these diseases. So not that we want to pat ourselves on the back, but I think you all know that we've put a lot of financial resources and program resources into the arbovirus program, the vector control program, and we have great partners with the cities, with the base, and with the county in terms of trying to keep mosquito habitat under control as best we can. I think we've done a good job of working with our partners and doing that. We don't go out and clear out waterways. We don't have the resources to do that, but where we find slow-living waterways, we'll let our partners know. So it's up to you, sir, if you all want to stay a little bit past two for Laura to give her presentation on academic affairs, or we can postpone until next time. It's your choice.
How long do you think she'll need?
I can try 5 minutes.
All right, let's go for it.
Yeah.
Come on up.
Yes. Yeah.
That's it. Let's talk about the emerging issues.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So just a little bit of background. I started here in late February. It's a brand new position as the Academic Affairs Coordinator. And where we were in late February was that different people were doing coordination of interns and orientation that was in addition to their regular job duties. So ISUCANON is now centralized, and we have the intern allocation the same for every student, but now it's been updated. Obviously, residents are the same as, you know, public health students. And then if we have a lack of a clinical services master calendar, we have that now. There was no preceptor training. We just got the first module done, and we're ready to roll that out to our preceptors here in the district. There was inconsistent evaluation for interns. They're working on that. And then a lack of preceptor feedback with interns. So now we have that form that interns can fill out and give that feedback to our preceptors. Chef, my relationship to the strategic plan 2.4, interested in looking at it. And then just very briefly, coordination, recruitment, and community engagement is what I do. So like I said, and after all the intern inquiries, any academic affairs related anything, I answer online training that the interns have to complete before they start here, orientation, and then intern processing. Engage with different academic and community partners, recruit new programs, students, you know, universities as needed, new faculty, all of the different student research presentations that they have or symposia, and go to that. So where we're headed is enhanced academic affairs. We are getting ready for medical student researchers coming on this summer, and they're completing it next year, so they have two rotations of research. UNLV, yes. This is UNLV School of Medicine. And then increasing capacity by strengthening our practice research opportunities with academic partners, more comprehensive preceptor development here, assisting with job placement after EMS certification, and then we have a food safety handler program for at-risk youth. Offer mentoring opportunities here for our preceptors. The interns. And then we're seeking to be an academic health department. I just wanted to talk about that really briefly. So an academic health department is really just the equivalent of a teaching hospital, but for public health. And so we wanted more shared personnel, more shared resources, ability to write, you know, grants together, letters of support, and have access to data, and really work together with our different academic partners. So UNLV School of Nursing is actually the first one that's poised. I kind of think this is on a different screen, but they're poised to sign an agreement with us. They're going to be the first one. These are our current affiliation agreements. We have multiple programs within some of these. And then we are trying to get master affiliation agreements with all of UNLV and all of UNR because they've requested that. And then our intern selection priorities are the first choice local students at local universities. I chair the Academic Affairs Committee, that's a picture from March. And this is what we do in the Economic Affairs Committee. And then just some selected accomplishments that I think I've just briefly touched on. Like I said, you know, we'll be school nursing, coordinating all the, any student activities, clinical services, so we can easily see where all of the interns, residents, and fellows are at any one time. And then preceptor manual, centralized application registration system, online preceptor evaluation form, staff intern request form, started at intern success newsletter, I'll just briefly show you a picture of, and then again, preceptor training. Priority preceptor development, the academic health department agreement and implementation, and then clear expectations for everyone involved. That's our intern success newsletter. We put that out every 2 months, and it just highlights what our interns are doing here at the district.
Chris, thank you, Ms. Valentin. Great report. Any questions?
Just a comment. We get requests from everywhere and everyone, and especially our clinical services area, but other areas have been inundated with those requests, so we had to do something to consolidate and prioritize. So we're probably not going to be taking any more high school students. I don't think we can do that anymore, as much as I would like to get people interested, but we're focusing in on nursing, and we're focusing in on medical residencies. Right now we have an agreement, all of the internal medicine, they're now UNLV. I think all of the emergency medicine from UNLV are coming, and we're just getting ready to sign an agreement with pulmonology. They'll be coming into our TB clinic. So our priorities would be physicians, nurses, and to some degree pharmacy as well, because we've been able to take in a lot of those. And wherever else we can bring in folks, we'll do that. But those, we have to prioritize. We're just too small to take in everyone.
And I just add one more thing. We actually have 136 interns year to date, compared with 72 last year.
Impressive. And I forgot that advanced practice nursing students and PAs also priorities for us.
Very good. Thank you for your report. Agenda item number 7 is emerging issues for the Facility Advisory Board. Are there any emerging issues that anybody on the phone or in person may have? Or perhaps issues you would like us to discuss at our next meeting? I do know that we were noticed, Dr. Iser, related to the West Care closure. Did you hear that, Joe? The West Care location is closed,
or do you have to enforce the street one?
Robert, are you on the phone? Robert Vickery from West Care was.
Yeah, on our committee, he's usually sitting right us. So we just may want to track the impact of that, because I know many people, many health systems have supported that location for many, many years. It's kind of financially, may just compound our closure issue and something to add to the list, Mr. Hammond, but we may want to just watch that closely, especially through the season, because it was a huge community resource for all of us to help decompress and get patients in the right location. So I'll just put that on the record. Agenda item number 8 is public comment. This time's dedicated for items that are not on the agenda that the public may want to speak to. Seeing none and hearing none, I will make a motion or have a motion for adjournment.
Second.
Thank you, everyone. I appreciate your time and commitment to this committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.